Dr. Nussbaum, good morning and welcome to Lawrence. You've been a much-in-demand commencement speaker over the course of your distinguished career, as evidenced by your 50 honorary degrees. How has your advice to graduating seniors changed over the years? What will be the biggest difference between what you'll tell our Lawrence seniors today and what you told your first commencement audience?
Of course, I don't even remember what I said in my first commencement address, but I think it's not like I'm recommending different things, but I'm recommending them against different opposition. When I first started teaching and thinking about higher education, the main opposition to the kind of liberal education that Lawrence is committed to was from a kind of elitist conservatism that said, well, we shouldn't explore race, we shouldn't learn about women, we should just read the high monuments of Western civilization. And so what I needed to say is, why is it important to learn about race, to learn about women, to learn about the different groups that make up our world? And now those conservatives I almost regard with nostalgia because, I mean, they aren't around anymore, or the ones that were there have changed their position. Because now, all of a sudden, it's all about jobs, jobs, jobs. And this narrow kind of dumbing down of higher education to a narrowly instrumental model, which I think is much more threatening to the life of the mind than the old kind of conservatism was. Because, if you're reading Shakespeare, you're still reading something wonderful that's going to stimulate your mind, and never mind if their reasons for doing it were not quite the right reasons. But today, the idea is, let's not do liberal arts at all. So I think at Lawrence, I don't really need to tell people that that they should do that because they've done it. But why is it important? Why should they view it as something precious that might be taken away? Not here, perhaps not right away, but at lots of state universities, it's already very much under threat.
You've been an advocate and a champion of liberal education. How relevant is a liberal arts degree in today's world?
Well, I think it's more than ever, because, it stimulates a kind of respectful and deliberative political debate, and there's no time in American history when we need that more. There's nothing deliberative or reflective at all about our political culture. And it also stimulates curiosity and involvement in the different groups that make up our world. And I think this is more crucial than ever if big problems like environmental problems, racial animosity, religious animosity are going to be solved. So I think when people think narrowly about jobs, they're selling short democracy. And we need to think, what is it that keeps democracy healthy?
Has the PhD become the new bachelor's degree?
Oh, I think people should only do a PhD if they have a passion for some particular subject and they really are prepared to risk not getting a job in that subject. I mean, if somebody wants to do a philosophy PhD, I have to tell them that there aren't very many jobs out there and that they should do it only if they really just love it and want to do it for its own sake. So no, not at all. I think the bachelor's degree has the great value in America, not in most of the world, that it does two things. It gives you a major subject that might lead to a career, and it also gives you a liberal education that everyone shares that prepares you for citizenship and life. And PhD training has nothing to do with that.
Retiring President Jill Beck has made a concerted effort to collaborate with other institutions, such as with our LUR1 program, in which current students spend the summer working with an alumni researcher at an R1 university. Is collaboration one of the solutions to some of higher education's bigger challenges?
One kind that Lawrence is very good at, and that I think needs to be done more and more here and elsewhere, is collaboration across academic disciplines, in team teaching, interdisciplinary teaching. And I try to do a lot of that myself and in my own institution. It's lucky for me that it's a very interdisciplinary institution, because I'm a member of seven different departments, and if I couldn't bring them together, it would be totally crazy. But collaboration between institutions, I think it's particularly valuable for a small school like Lawrence, because I think liberal arts colleges give a better undergraduate education than the Ivy League schools, for the most part. because the teaching is much more hands-on, access to faculty is much greater, and the careful attention to students' writing is greater. But the one problem that small schools have is that they may not have enough courses in some specialized field in science. And so to solve that problem, collaboration is really very, very helpful.
It seems massive open online courses are all the rage these days. To what extent do you see MOOCs threatening the future of a traditional residential liberal arts college education?
Well, I don't know how big the threat is yet. I think no one knows. But I think if it catches on, it's bad. Because I think online courses are fine for people who otherwise would have no access to higher education. And that might be true. It's been true for a long time for working people in many places, for people who are in very remote parts of our country, and for people in countries of the world who just can't afford a higher education. But it's just no substitute. I mean, it's a poor second place, if second at all, because the interaction is the key to the education, the interaction with other students in the classroom, and the interaction with faculty. So I just can't really imagine how that could be anything but just very far below. And I'm sure people try to make it more interactive, but it just isn't the same thing.
Have you ever been approached, or would you consider teaching an online course?
No. No, I am known to be a Luddite as far as technology goes. I mean, I don't even read blogs. I have a whole policy of not using the internet except for email and of course, searching for information and so on. So no, I would be the last person that would do that.
Aside from the sheer number of students online courses can reach, do you see other advantages to MOOCs?
Well, low cost, I guess. I mean, I don't even know what they're charging people for that. But, you know, if I imagine, let's say, India, a country that I work in a lot, where there's tremendous demand for higher education and it well exceeds the supply, and a lot of what's rushing into the void is really bad quality, well, I think that a MOOC from a good place could be better than actually what's on offer in some of the places in India. And so, yeah, I mean, it could be a way of solving a short-term problem of demand outstripping supply.
Does the University of Chicago offer any MOOCs?
Well, we have been not very involved in that. I think there are some individuals who are involved in that, but not in
institutional-wide, not so much. Mm-hmm. Over the years, you've been hailed as one of America's most respected scholars and celebrated thinkers. What responsibilities and what privileges come with that kind of mantle?
Oh, boy. Well, I think not every scholar has to go and work for social justice, and not every philosopher, because if you're a logician, well, there might be some way you would serve social justice by donating money to some cause or by bringing up your children in a certain way. But, you know, given that I do political philosophy, I do think that I have a responsibility to work in such a way that it contributes to practical causes that I believe in. And I've tried to figure out how to do that. And in the long run, I've helped to set up an international organization called the Human Development and Capability Association that pioneers academic work that feeds into development policy. So yeah, that kind of responsibility I think about a lot. And with that goes responsibility to use some of my amazingly leisured life. I mean, I think we're so lucky in the academy that we can do what we want for all day, you know. To use some of that to address public causes of importance. And the first time I wrote on higher education was just for that reason. I thought, okay, I've spent 2 years writing a big book on the emotions, and I really love doing that, but now there are these controversies about higher education. I've written a couple of op-eds, but let me take a year of my time and write a book. So from time to time, I do that, and I address a public issue, which I just think is an important issue. And I do feel that more scholars should do that. And, well, you asked what are the privileges that come with that? Oh, I get to meet fascinating people. I get to travel a lot. I get to just have a wonderful time whenever I go somewhere. And so I feel, but you know, the main thing is just, as I said, being able to spend your whole day doing the thing you love. I can't imagine what could be a better life than that.
You've been an invitee to the White House?
Well, only in the most indirect way. There was this exhibit of photographs of women that Annie Leibovitz did at the Corcoran Gallery, and they had a reception for all of those of us who were in the book at the White House. That was the only time. And yes, I met President Clinton and Hillary Clinton at that point, but not on any other more intellectual occasion.
Would you share your assessment of Lawrence as an institution in the world of higher education?
Well, you know, I have just been blown away by the classes I've snuck into with this freshman kid of mine. So one was a political science class about American politics, and another was an introductory econ class. And I just thought, wow, I want to stay here the whole semester to have this class, because in fields like that, which are not my main fields, I just pick up things here and there. You know, I'm self-educated. And just to have a really wonderful course. And I'm just amazed at the way that these teachers can combine sophistication with absolute clarity. I mean, because these introductory courses that a freshman was taking were, of course, accessible to freshmen. And they were very clear. But I was also stimulated, and I was getting something out of the way the issues were presented. And I just think they're just so lucky to have that. Of course, in the freshman studies, they do music. This is the only place I've ever seen of which that's true. Mm-hmm. Because most places, you know, they expect that every faculty member could teach Shakespeare or Aeschylus, but they don't ever expect that faculty could teach Stravinsky. Mm-hmm. But here they are in freshman studies, and they're all doing Stravinsky. And I think that's fantastic. It should happen more often.